Hi, my name is Jennifer Buchanan. I'm a certified music therapist and author, and I am so delighted to be a part of the Talkin' Blues podcast today.
I'm going to start with the beginning. Tell me how music came into your life.
What a beautiful first question, because, you know, as a music therapist and working with people, asking a question like that opens up an opportunity for us to hear our life story as we're going back. And when you're asking me that question, I'm already feeling like I'm stumbling a little bit, because it's normally me who asks the questions, and here you are taking me back. And music came into my life, not fast and furious like some people. My home was relatively quiet, as I recall it. The first music would have been mostly out of the television, you know, and the early childhood broadcasts of Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street. And I can even remember the very first time I heard the theme from Spider-Man that came on right before the Electric Company. And that was, I loved it. And I would dance in front of that screen that gave me a lot of company in those early days. And then I would say the next would have been in public school. And how grateful am I for that, where I happened to go to a school that I learned later on had an exceptionally huge array of music, you know. We had music teachers that taught us things like ukulele and even had small ensembles, but I was already in a concert band and a jazz band by later half of elementary school. So I was very fortunate to have quite a bit of live, interactive, social music, leading to probably the piece de resistance, which was being cast as the lion in The Wizard of Oz, and doing that before junior high. So it was a lot of great opportunity to create and make and share music at an early time.
Wow. And I presume your first instrument was a piano or a guitar?
Yeah, it was piano. It was piano with Mr. Nikowitz. He would show up. He would come to our house. We had very little money. And I can remember the day a piano came into our house, and I was shocked. I didn't know where we got the means to get a piano like that. And then all of a sudden, Mr. Nikowitz in his fedora hat would start coming to the house on Saturday mornings, 9:15. Like, that's how much I remember all that. And he was the sort of teacher that would carry a brief, it would take him a long time to walk from the car to the front door. And his briefcase always looked like the papers were falling out of them. All the music scores are falling out of the, like, he just was so disheveled and interesting character. And he would come into the house, and he was the piano teacher that would just put a piece of music on the stand and say, play this. And then you'd play this. Oh, that was lovely. Okay, let's try this one. There was nothing about perfecting anything. It was about sight reading and trying new things and finding out a song that maybe I'd like and want to take to the end. It was a very interesting style.
So what did that do to you in your appreciation of music?
Well, certainly the appreciation was massive. The confidence was strong. The interest, the curiosity was there. What I don't think has ever happened is that level of perfectionism that I have seen other people achieve. The musicianship that I watch in others and I go, oh, that is so remarkable. I have become quite comfortable with exploring music and trying music and being curious about music. And that has been a strength of mine throughout my career. But perfecting a piece, whoa, still not good at that.
Okay, so I wonder, was there ever a time when you thought you would pursue music as a musician?
There was a moment in time during Expo 86, and I was in grade 11 or 12 at the time, and I went to this audition vocally to be a backup singer for Long John Baldry.
Wow.
And they really liked me. They liked me a lot. And I can remember I had an opportunity in that moment to be a backup singer for someone who was awesome. And then they found out that I wasn't of age, and it would have been tough to take me into the bars at that age. I don't know how I got there. I think you had to be 21 to audition, but I looked older. So I can remember having that as a moment. And then it passed and it was all okay. It's not like I was crying about it. It was one of those moments where I tried something and I was curious and I enjoyed the process. But have I ever thought of being a musician?
Well, you are a musician, right?
Right.
Like, it's not like you're not a musician.
No, exactly. But I have never been a professional musician. I have never pursued it in the way that I have pursued being a professional music therapist.
Okay, I'm not completely sure what the difference is because because your job, and I know it encompasses a lot of different things.
Yeah.
But playing music in front of people is one of the things that you do as a music therapist. So I don't know what the difference between being a musician and being what you do.
Right.
Like, is there a distinction in your mind? Is there a difference?
Yeah. Over the years, it has started happening for sure. I don't know if I'm still going to explain it very well right now. When I was 21 and I graduated with a degree in music therapy and I moved from living in Vancouver area my entire life to Calgary to have my first internship. And I knew that I had this degree. I knew that few people anywhere are going to know what a music therapist was. To put it in perspective, I was number 133 of music therapists across Canada back in 1991. And I wanted to do the work so badly. How it's different than being a musician is I don't feel performer. There's not any part of me that feels I'm connecting people to my music. I'm connecting people to their own music. And I'm connecting them to areas in their life that they feel they need strengthened. And I'm using the modality of music to help them do that. Very similar to someone would do talk therapy or to provide exercises in physiotherapy. I'm using this incredible resource we have, accessible, life-giving resource of music, where they can strengthen elements of their speech and their movements and their mood and their motivation. And what I'm sharing with them is how to connect to that. And so I knew I had all this when I was 21 at the Y. So I couldn't define it at the time. But I didn't know how to get it to the people. You can imagine if no one had heard about it, it's not like the phone was ringing off the hook. We didn't have computers at the time. No one's going, oh, I'm looking for a music therapist.
but it's still playing music.
It is, right?
Like, so, I mean, if you were a horrible musician who couldn't sing in tune, then could you be a music therapist?
Oh, that is such a, because not all music therapists are vocalists, not all music therapists are pianists, not all music therapists play the guitar. We do generally have one primary instrument, but I have worked with many a music therapist as they have felt that feeling of, oh, I'm not a good singer. How am I going to connect with people? And I encourage them that over time, we, as musicians within our music therapy practice, with practice, we do get better. You know, all of this does get better. But by staying focused on the client and their needs and what they're needing in the moment, and us finding a way to, yes, share music, either live or recorded, or through a really poignant question around, just like you asked me at the beginning, how did you enter into music? How did music find you? Man, you can learn a lot about people. And when they're going through some of their most difficult moments and transitions, they might be in the hospital diagnosed with cancer. They might have 8 months to live. Those questions are what can bring the deepest amount of meaning into those moments. And as a therapist, you are witness to that. And your job is to support them with whatever they need.
Okay, so if we go back a bit, at what point did you decide that you wanted to get into music therapy?
Granny knew first. So when I was a tween, and so I've been doing the piano, I've been doing music in public school. Granddad at the age of 62 had his second major stroke and was placed in long-term care, 62. Like, he was no longer able to walk or talk. And Granny set up the family visits of when they were going to happen. And she put my family, so my mom and my dad and my sister and I, to Friday nights of all things. I was probably around 12, 13, 14, would rather have been at home watching Dallas. Dallas 1.0 was on TV. Right. And here I am at the long-term care hospital, and I just went to that familiar thing I told you about. I went right to the black and white TV in the corner, because that's where you went when you're going to hide and just be by yourself. And I didn't know how to interact with Granddad and where he was at, and the adults would hang around there. And people weren't really educating us kids as to ideas we could do or engaging us in conversations. Like, I was from the free range children's time where, you know, parents and kids did not interact in the same way they do today. We were all on our own. Right. And so it would be Granny that, you know, she had a moment and she came over and she said, Jenny, would you learn your granddad's favorite song and come in and play it on your guitar next week? And so that was the beginning. I went in and I did that. And
what was the song?
It was White Cliffs of Dover by Vera Lynn. Yeah.
How easy was it for you to learn that song?
Wasn't too hard, you know, like, you know, four chords and a, you know, throw in a minor once in a while. It sounded pretty good.
Okay, so once again, you're a musician.
And it was nice. It was nice to play that song for Granddad. The screaming lady down the hall, started to sing, and the wandering guy wandered on in, and Granddad, who couldn't walk or talk, started to cry because it meant something to him. And over the next several years, I would hear about music therapy a dozen times. Nobody hears about music therapy. I heard about music therapy at the time. And Granny would eventually find out that it was offered at Capilano University in North Vancouver, one of, I think it was only three schools across Canada at the time, three or four. And she wrote me a reference letter.
Based on that incident?
Based on every Friday. So that's what happened. Every Friday night became long-term care night with Jen. You know, and yeah, singing with the residents, and it was a pleasure.
So I wonder, as a young musician and witnessing this connection with your audience, what did that teach you? What did it do to you?
I feel I started feeling for others very early, recognizing that how I feel about something isn't necessarily how someone else feels about something. This being human, we go through a lot personally, and I feel that I started seeing our elders in particular at that time, for being as young as I was, I saw them as people. And I know that sounds a little silly, but, they weren't old people. To me, they became people with stories that they had to share. And even at that time, people weren't using the words Alzheimer's. You know, we were using senility still. Like, the language has changed so much. And I can remember thinking, oh, that doesn't quite fit, you know, because they're still telling me stories of their past. Because, of course, music brings out all these stories. And you learn a lot about them. So I would say these experiences, and all the experiences that have followed as a music therapist, have reminded me how uniquely wonderful people are, whether they're grumpy like Granddad was, or a screaming lady, or a wandering guy. We all have a story to tell, and music is just such a great way to get there.
Did you, before you went to school as a music therapist, did you see other evidence? Like, was it based on your experience with the seniors home that you followed, or were you able to tap into some of the other things that you obviously do now, working with the younger kids and working with other people? But did you have that experience before you went to school?
Like, before I went to the music therapy school?
Yeah.
No, I would say again that I got some information. MTV, I'm totally dating myself in this interview. I love it. Everyone's
we should
be
also
able
mention
to...
the Sean Cassidy
album. Oh, yeah, I've got a Sean Cassidy album behind me. We'll talk about that in a minute. So MTV, while I was in first year university, I think, did a special news broadcast out of the UK where they were showing what music therapy was at the Nordoff and Robbins School in the United Kingdom. And Paul McCartney was one of the people that they were interviewing. I think it was called The Power of Music. So around this power of music. And I can remember watching this one particular aspect of it, which was working with kids, like you're mentioning, in the school system. It was working with a young girl with Down syndrome. And I went, oh my goodness, this is what I'm meant to do. You know, like there was just no question around how music connects all of us together to our best selves. And yeah, it was pretty great to see that.
So you come out of school, you're in Calgary, and you're saying, okay, how am I going to draw? Like, I don't know, at that point, as a music therapist, 136 or whatever, what you have or what your expectations are and what do you see the future to be?
Right.
And this is no different than me asking a lot of guitar players about if they saw the future or whatever.
Right.
So when you came out of school, did you have an idea of what you wanted to accomplish or did you have goals into what you were doing?
I would say no to that. I would say I had no specific goals as to how this was all going to work out. But I also had the feeling it was all going to work out. I was also pursuing truly at that level of interest and passion. I'm grateful I have that because what I've been told is not everybody does at times or have not always felt that. But to be able to trust my just that the direction was going to unfold. And so I was saying that there were no computers at the time. I wanted to do this career that nobody else had heard of. So what do you do? And there was something that just drew me to going to a local library in Signal Hill here in Calgary. It's still not that far from my home. And I walked in and I went to the circulation desk and there was this wise looking adult behind the circulation desk. And I can remember, and you know, I was 21, like I was just like I'm doing right now. I'm probably just prattling away about what I was doing and what I thought music therapy was and what my schooling was and who I wanted to work with and that I saw this MTV show and this is what I want to do. And I'm sure I just went on it. And I can remember her calm response of, I can help you. And I can remember that just caught me off guard. Wow. So someone can help me. And I've remembered that since, because what a wonderful thing to be able to tell a young person after hearing them talk and being able to say, and wanting to say, I can help you. It meant so much to me. It changed my life. So she went behind the desk and she brought out this thing called the Blue Book. And it's literally a blue book. And it has all the lists of all the social services, the hospitals, the community programs. It was broken down between medical to working with individuals in group homes to working at schools. And it had a contact name and phone numbers. It's called the Blue Book. And I couldn't take it out of the library, but I was allowed to photocopy it, but I was so poor at the time. Like, I, you know, you're living on itchy band noodles and you know, like it just, that's the beginning. Right. And so I started writing it out on foolscap paper, you know, all the, like what we did. And I got the information and I dedicated myself to making a call a day, one call a day, to one of these agencies.
And what was the, what was the selling point? Like, what would you tell them?
Right. Oh gosh, I can barely remember again, but I know I would say, I know I barely had to say, I'm a music therapist new to your city. Can I come and show you what music therapy is? And I think it's because I used the word music in a sector of care that didn't have music at the time. You know, there wasn't music happening at the hospitals like there are today. Musicians weren't being invited in, or and music therapists were certainly not sitting by the bedside. And I can remember that my very first client was Scenic Bow Legion Group Home. And they hired me for that Friday. So they were my first phone call and invited me on Friday. And they paid me to be there. And my business was set up. And I started setting my rates. And I wanted therapy rates. I've done the schooling. I've done the time. I want to be a therapist. I'm ready to go. Yeah.
Okay. So obviously that gig went well.
It went so good. And, you know, there are people that we see today over 30 years, like certain group homes and facilities that we started back in 1991, 1992, and 1993, and we're still going there every week.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so you make this call, you get the gig, you get paid, and now you have to get other gigs. Was that easy?
You know, the question that I asked each placement after they saw what a music therapy was, so long as they saw the benefits and, you know, that the benefits of the improved mood, the motivation, the engagement, you know, so long as they were seeing the benefits, I felt very comfortable to say, just repeating that I'm new to the city. Do you have anywhere you could refer me to? And I found that the Calgary community at the time and today were very free with their referrals and loved to share what was happening.
What surprised you? I mean, you go through schooling, so you have some ideas to what you would provide and the results that you would get. Yeah. But do you remember any early surprises that kind of shocked you in your successes?
I don't know if the successes shocked me. I think it's when things didn't go well. That's what shocked me. It was like, oh, so this doesn't always work. I think that was... And it was mostly, I'm sure, due to my inexperience as a music therapist that I wouldn't always know the best technique or the best connector. One of my earlier placements in the early 90s, and again, I was young, but Dr. William Grisdale was the head of palliative care, which is end-of-life care. Had heard about me, invited me to come and meet with him at our general hospital here. And he said, I would like to hire you for 2 days a week to work here on the palliative care unit. That was big. I had no particular palliative care experience. You only have so much experience after your schooling, and palliative care wasn't one of those. And I was not articulate enough, or I was probably nervous to say how limited my experience was in that. Because looking back, I know if I would have asked for help or for some deeper education or the best book to read or something, it would have been really helpful, but I didn't do that. A third of the unit were young male AIDS patients, because that was the day. And I didn't know. I'd worked a lot with the elderly. I'd worked with a lot of developmental disabilities at that point, but working with a 32-year-old male with kids at home who had very few weeks left on this planet, that was new. And I can remember going home after each shift, recognizing just how much I needed to learn, and that I just recognized that I just wasn't experienced enough in that. And I was so worried that I was going to let the patients down. So that was surprising for me, how deeply I felt that.
So I can imagine how difficult that would have been for you. I mean, just personally to deal in that situation. I mean, I, and once again, I know you went to school for this, so I know that you knew you were going to be working in seniors' mm-hmm. homes, and you knew you were going to be working mm-hmm. with people who weren't going to be around a long time or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's a completely different situation. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that? How did you deal with the mental aspects of what you were going through?
I didn't reach out enough back then. I look at those early days as such learning moments for me. Now, calling people that are really strong in these areas and surrounding myself with people who are knowledgeable and reading the right research and doing, that's what I would do. And I still do that today when I'm walking into a new setting or learning a new term. But at the time, I think I was also overwhelmed with just the how busy I was. I was very fortunate. I had a full caseload within 6 months of starting my practice, and I would be hiring my first contractor within that first year to so we could and literally started a business of music therapy at that time. So I did the best I could with what I knew, but it's not even a regret. I use it truly as a learning moment. I wish I would have known a little bit more back then, though, for the patients themselves. I feel like I had such a gift by being able to meet so many of those young people at that time, and many of their stories still are going through my head. And I hope that I wasn't the complete disaster that sometimes I think I might have been.
The power of music makes total sense to me because I know what it does to me. Mm-hmm. I also understand very easily how music can be very helpful to older people because it conjures up older memories and the history. When you work with young kids who don't have the history of music, how does music become so powerful with young kids who didn't grow up listening to, or, you know, you're working with 5-year-olds or whatever that don't have a large history of music. Tell me about that side of music.
Yeah, I like that. And you know what? We also work with adults and elders who feel like they haven't had much music in their lives either. And sometimes those are our best sessions, you know, is connecting people to music that haven't had a broad background. So there's a story. I had the pleasure of working with Marissa. So I was saying about MTV, and I was working with, or I saw the work with this young girl with Down syndrome. Well, it wouldn't be too many years in, around 1994 or 95, where one of my contracts was at a school. And it was during the time where we were just starting to do the integration of the special needs classroom into the regular school. And that's how we were talking about it. I remember when I was young, we never saw the kids in the special needs classroom. The bus came a little bit later. It left a little bit earlier. We never interacted. They didn't come to assembly with us. Everyone was very segregated, but this was when integration was starting to happen and we were becoming a more closely knit community, but it had its difficulties, its problems. And this one school thought, you know, it would be really great if we had music therapy to work with these kids that were having difficulty communicating verbally with others. And so my very first client there was this young girl with Down syndrome. And I can remember the teacher coming out of the classroom and she said to me, you do know she doesn't know how to communicate. And I went, okay. Marissa and I walked to the music room. We had the entire music room for our session. I was going to see four kids that morning, and she was my first. And I can remember that I sat at the piano. She sat by a cymbal. And I gave her a mallet, and I did a Middle Eastern little improv that, so it wasn't based on anything familiar. It was brand new. And as soon as I struck the first chord and looked at her, she took that mallet and just went bang. And then I struck the second chord and she went bang. And I strike twice, boom, boom. And she went bang, bang. And that's, we're communicating, we're creating new language through song, and improvisation is a core value within music therapy of making live music that speaks when words are not available.
Is it a long-term thing? Like, I can see immediately that there's communication and there's something that's happening. Does that translate into something that's a long-term effect?
Yeah. So, a great question, right? I guess it depends on what you're measuring. In this case, for someone like Marissa, doesn't mean she's ever going to speak. At that time, we didn't know that. But I can tell you within the next decade of lots of music therapy and speech therapy, she did. But you don't know that in the moment. And maybe that's not even a goal. And in this case, it wasn't a goal. In this case, it was she had just been placed into a classroom with neurotypical kids. And she had to navigate her way through that. And there's no way that sense of self sometimes gets lost when you feel like you don't fit in or that you're different from everybody else. And this gave her an opportunity to lead me. So she could use that symbol to lead me into the next thing. She could follow me if she wants, or she could lead me. She ended up being quite a sassy person. And we could express that through the music. So having an opportunity every week to spend 30 minutes with a therapist where you had some level of control and could be bossy and sassy and everything you want to be with absolutely no judgment, that's the therapy. And that's what she would have got. Long-term, yes, she definitely would write a song later in her life. She would speak more articulately. She would socially engage with her peers where we would do group therapy with a mix of her class. So a lot of things were to come, but that's when the goals are going to shift pending what that individual needs.
I wonder how you look at music differently because of the experiences that you have as a therapist. Like, are you able to just listen to the radio or put on a CD or whatever and take in music as a music fan? Or is it more clinical, analytical? Is it? I mean, I presume you are a music fan and you...
Yeah.
So has it changed the way you look at music in any way?
There's always a part of me that's probably, when I listen to music, because I'm just a fan, like you said, there always is that part of me that goes, oh yeah, this feels good. And I remind my own self how music, just in its natural form of playing through a speaker or when I'm going to a concert and me just being absorbing what is happening around me, how I go, gosh, music itself can do a lot of the heavy lifting of helping me feel what I need to feel in the moment, and just that level of appreciation or feeling soothed or comforted or energized or whatever I'm feeling. I don't know if I can't even imagine me more deeply feeling it than anybody else. But when I'm planning a session for somebody, I'm so thinking about them and what's going to be the best way I can translate all these things music does for me and the world into what's going to help them reach their aspirations.
Can music ever be a negative thing?
I've been on a book tour lately with my new book, Wellness Well Played. And it's all about the power of a playlist. Mm-hmm. And one of the big questions I keep being asked is sad music bad? That's what I keep getting asked, because so it feels like there's this certain group of people over the last 2 years that have been drawn to sad music. Oh my gosh, I'm finding myself listening to sad music a lot, or what they would deem sad music. And I'm going to answer your question. First of all, I always say we reach for the music that we need typically. And the reason you're reaching for sad music is because you're looking to be understood. And music has that capacity to understand you and to validate exactly how you're feeling in the moment. And it's really quite wonderful. Most of the time afterwards, you feel a bit better. And that's typical. So sad music is not bad. But if you listen to sad music and you start feeling sadder, that's definitely something we need to explore a little further. That is when I do recommend seeing a mental health professional for sure. The other time is when you stop listening to music. I've talked to lots of musicians about that. They've had breaks in their music listening themselves, and it often is an indicator, and we need to delve into what that is indicating. And there are people, including music therapists, that would love to work with you in regards to that. So can music be harmful? It's very, where I work now, I work in corrections. And we often talk about the music that ramps us up. And ramping up into a crime is probably not the best use of music, but it works that way. It can totally do it. Right. And it's because it functions like a drug, but it's completely legal, but it can ramp us up. So we will have conversations around how music can do that. And it leads us into also choosing more healthy music for us. And it's going to be different for everybody, but it is very interesting. But it's not the same for everybody. There's no prescription for music. What ramps up one person will not ramp somebody else up. But we do need to investigate a little bit when it ramps us up into a crime.
So this new book, was it a project that started because of the pandemic?
It was happening a little bit before. It probably wouldn't have gotten finished as fast if the pandemic didn't happen. So we were talking about when you go to a physiotherapist, they give you exercises in between your sessions, you know, just so you can keep the progress happening. One of my favorite exercises to give clients is about creating purposeful playlists. And the entire book is based around the playlist. It starts with going into the history of, you know, we look at the cassette and the CD, and although that's all very interesting, I did that completely for myself because it was just so fun to reflect and go back in time. And it was fun for me to also look at that information. And then it goes into putting together our life's soundtrack and breaking our life down into decades and starting to put the music into each of those decades so you can see this picture of what your life sounds like. And then it goes into a variety of different playlists that we can create to help reach the goals you will have on your wellness plan. And it was an absolute joy to write. I had a really great editor and the designer for the book itself. It felt like a piece of art as we were working on it. Yeah.
I grew up making mixtapes, so it's very close to my heart, the idea of playlists, and, and I still make.
Did you give them to, were you someone who shared the mixtapes, or did you keep them for yourself?
Both, because I know I've given mixtapes to other people. I also make playlists for when people come over for dinner, that I would just do a playlist that I know that these people hopefully will like while we entertain. But music is such a big part of, you know, who I am and what I like. So I appreciate the fact that you would write a book about it.
and I think it was those early music memories of us. Remember, did you have like a, did you sit at the dual cassette and with your thumbs and you have to press like the play and record it totally simultaneously?
Mine was record to tape. It was always album to tape. So just never
so good.
Cassette to, they, you know, and I always, when I talk to people about it, we always talk about that last song. Like you might have like a minute and 40 seconds left on the tape and what song to fit, right? And then I had a friend who used to just put on whatever song, and if it just cut out in the middle, it cuts out in the middle, which I found like horrible. Like you can't just have the song end halfway, so.
Totally.
But that's it's a neat idea, like the whole idea of playlists.
I love that, yeah.
So you have to tell me before we end this session about that Sean Cassidy album that's sitting behind you.
So, yes. So I have got Born Late. This is the original vinyl behind me, 1977.
Is it signed?
It is not signed. Okay. Can you help get me to Nashville? I'm ready to go find them. I have become, so over the pandemic and as I was working on this book, one of the stories that came back was the Sean Cassidy story. So I made sure that it's become a part. And I've become friends with him on Facebook. He's not friends back yet, but I've been following him everywhere he's going. And so when I was younger and I did a jump off of the monkey bars at school, it was Halloween, and I broke my leg. And in the day, it was like a 6-inch cast that went around you. So what it meant was there was no trick-or-treating that night. And it would be the first time that I could go without parental supervision. Remember, so I was saying we were free-range kids. So I was probably in grade 3 and you could go out without your parents. And I can remember realizing I couldn't go out because I had this huge cast on my leg and I was really sore. And so mom knew how to fix that problem. And she came home with my very first album. And my very first album was that album. And you know that feeling of when you take your thumb and you slice open the plastic wrap carefully, you know, with my long fingernail.
And hopefully you don't get a paper cut.
Totally. And so, you know, it saved sort of that Halloween, and it's given me a positive memory, which could have been a very negative memory. And that's a good reminder for me about music. Music has can help us turn things around. And I'm really encouraging people why I wrote the book, why I'm talking about using music, exploring new music is really important. Stay in a growth mindset, because it can help us take those next steps and not stay in the mundane. And yeah.
My final question to you, and I don't know if this is a fair question, and you might have answered it already, but what's the greatest thing you've learned from music? Whether it be as a therapist or as a fan?
You know, I guess that it is that it can call forth my strengths. It's a sure friend. When I need it most, but also when I just want a casual friend to hang out with, you know? And that would be that it can do more, and that there's still more to learn about it, that it keeps me curious and wanting to engage with it in a new way and explore it in a new way and staying open and probably the most important thing. I can't imagine a more meaningful way to connect with another human on this planet than through our music exchange, whatever that may be.
Well said. Jennifer, thank you so much for doing this. It was a real pleasure meeting you.
So nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.